Birth, Volume 3, The Gathering, Chapter 22. It was hard to impress General Wes Morlaix. 32 years of military service had taught him to manage by difference. He didn't want to waste his time with what was going right, because it required no leadership, and the last thing he wanted to hear was that things were going wonderfully, right before his forces are destroyed in battle. No one needed to tell him that his pawns were stacked too deep diagonally. He didn't want to see a report showing that recruitment numbers were meeting projected needs. He abhorred getting voluminous reports containing everything that was following his orders or anticipations. He had never given a compliment in his entire military career, regardless of the commendations and medals he had approved. His mother had taught him well. That is why he was surprised to see the slim report in his black steel inbound shelf this morning. One spaceship had a mere 42 craft that were short-manned. Nearly 500 attack vessels were fully staffed. He considered going to the reserves to call up 50 more men to take the controls of those remaining craft, but it would cost delays. Each passing day now would mean many more thousands of miles to fly, and far less chance of success. He felt a fever to launch his bombing campaign as quickly as possible. The report continued. The forward scouts failed to report any surface activity on the escaping planet. There were no Navy vessels at sea. There were no surveillance aircraft or strategic bombers in the air. All the missile silos were closed. There were no masses of troops anywhere on the planet. The Earth, upon which he had commanded the most feared air force the modern world had ever known, required a rule by fear. The politicians liked to call it the rule of law, but every nation knew that the law was backed by his bombers, fighters, and warthogs. No sound struck fear in the enemy like the high-altitude whine of a B-52 bomber fleet overhead. That sound meant every living thing for miles was going to die. He regretted the silence the enemy would experience before their cities disappeared from existence. The fact they would become afraid of the silence itself did not satisfy him. The few satellites that remained in orbit around the New World were a small number of older geosynchronous communications TV and a few GPS satellites. All the rest were still in orbit around the home planet. There would be no opposition. The surface of that world would be smoldering with death and smoke and fear. What difference would 42 less ships make, he asked himself, as he walked around his command center. No one looked at him, or even spoke to him, unless he specifically addressed them by name. The airmen, stuffed into cubicles in the command center, were all dressed in short sleeve, light blue shirts with khaki pants. Their heads were down, and their hands were busy with spreadsheets, trajectory calculations, and manpower support, and each one knew that if they faked anything, they would be discharged immediately and replaced. Succeeding in being selected for service at NORAD was a lifetime achievement for most armed service personnel, but the secrets buried deep in the Cheyenne Mountain facility were dark and drained the light out of a person until they were only at home in the shadows. They were like prisoners who felt the only way they could survive was to never leave this place that fed them and housed them and gave them purpose. After a single tour at NORAD, most of them were divorced. The operation at hand was the most horrible of all, but they scarcely felt sorrow anymore. Their purpose today was to accomplish what appeared to be the final mission. Operation Repo Man required every detail to be in order. They had trained men to use technology that had existed millennia before Adam's garden planet arrived here with Noah at its helm. The ultra-terrestrial race to whom the ships belonged nearly cracked the planet in two, defeating their ancient enemies. Two entire continents were plunged beneath the sea, killing hundreds of millions of inhabitants. The responding weaponry was so radioactive that the bones of the dead buried under Harappa were still hotter after 25,000 years than those from Ground Zero at Hiroshima. City after city was burned in ash and dust from the devastating war that racked the surface world. Those battles drove the survivors deep into the center of the planet and to the bottom of the oceans to wait for a clear day. But by the time the clear day came, they could no longer acclimate to the bright sunshine or to the whole new fauna of microbes that reached a new ecological balance on the surface of the Earth. So they sat and they waited for contact from someone. When a suitable intelligent visitor arrived, they were promised relief through new human genetic subjects and genetically engineered foods from the surface that were more compatible with their degenerated physiology. As the Nephilim promised, the castaways were delivered millions of live humans with whom to experiment and crossbreed. Within a few thousand years, they had reached a point of biological tolerance, but then the repayment was required. It was time to destroy another world. Wes scanned the room one more time to look for a nail sticking up. Managing troop morale was something of a work of art. The armies of the victors never rushed into battle because they loved their general. It was fear. Fear of being weak, rejected, or out of place. It was a fear of being out of step or non-compliant. Like a child compelled to win a street fight for fear of being beaten even worse at home for losing. His direct reports were dedicated to following his orders. Like a wife who had been battered nearly to death by a man who wanted to love her if only she would do whatever he asked, they only sought to please their commander. And if they followed his orders and stood in the position they were commanded, he would win the chess game again. Temporarily satisfied, he pivoted silently in crisp military fashion and marched with long strides down the hall to the wide stairs leading to the floor of the cavernous situation room. "Greetings, my master," said Wes in his practiced tone. "I see you have completed your battle plans, General," said Semyaza, without turning his head from the large display screens on the wall. "I must say, I am impressed with your training staff. The men mastered the controls of those fast attack ships pretty quickly," said Wes. "Men speak English. It doesn't mean they have mastered the language," said Semyaza. "They won't be dogfighting in space, if that's what you mean. My intel indicates the surface of the new Earth is absent of any resistance. We run the patterns I have outlined, and Operation Repo Man will be successful," said Wes, placing the papers behind his back in parade rest. "I see that you plan to attack the cities first. Share with me your twisted strategy," said Semyaza, finally turning his 12-foot frame to look at Wes. "If we strike the center of the city, as you previously pointed out, we will create too many victims. Lucifer will have little, if any, yield," said Wes, reaching into his pocket for a laser pointer. "If we strike on the edge of the cities, here, here, and here, we will drive the people as a panicked horde to the river. They will cannibalize to survive. They will be driven by the fire and explosions to the edge of the water. Then they will cast themselves in to drown rather than burn to death. They will climb over one another in the water like neighbor dogs fighting over a single pork chop, said Wes with a tiny bit of glee in his voice. Have you considered that they might not run? Asked Semyaza. They will run, said Wes firmly. General, I have seen thousands walk into the flames and straight to heaven, said Semyaza, raising his voice. Your paranoia is your weakness, said Wes, raising his in turn. And your overconfidence is yours, human, barked Semyaza, knowing that Wes had played him into expressing emotion. He calmed his mind, withdrawing to a defensive position in his thoughts. He was ready for the general's next thrust. Wes paused for a moment. He drew on his experience, but relied upon his lightning intuition that had astonished his commanders since the days of Lackland Air Force Base. We'll deploy HARP to disrupt their minds, said Wes. Go on, said Semyaza, not exposing himself to any aggression. The High-Frequency Active Auroral Research Program can reshape the ionosphere of this planet and use it as a reflector to send a focused beam to the new Earth. We will deploy the same mind-control technology we used in Operation Desert Storm. For weeks prior to that epic battle, which I might add was the most televised battle in history, we placed an ELF component on the beam to disrupt their sleep and their bowels, and entrained a mental image of doom. Those battle-hardened troops climbed out of their bunkers like tormented kittens and surrendered by the thousands, said Wes in a flat tone. Will you have enough time to weaken their will before you attack? Asked Semyaza. I'm not delaying the attack, because these are not battle-trained troops familiar with psychological warfare tactics. These are civilians seeking a sign, and I hope to give them one with a supernatural twist, said Wes. And you think they will succumb to these high-tech mind-control technologies? Asked Semyaza. When we originally tested this technology, we could trigger an ordinary girl to voraciously seduce politicians and world leaders with almost flawless success, knowing they were being filmed the entire time. How else do you think we spent trillions for criminal activities around the world and compromised America's capital without firing a shot? Everyone in Washington had a secret, and I knew them all. You know as well as I that most humans are willing to abdicate their own will for that of another, especially if it means they can get re-elected without opposition. We also entrained and activated dozens of mass shooters around the world to keep our war on terror alive at the cost of trillions more dollars. You will agree that Cold War tactics don't hold a candle to a well-publicized school shooting or a car bomb, said Wes. Your willingness to sacrifice the innocent to accomplish the mission has always fascinated me, said Semyaza. What would a good mission be without sacrificing the young and the innocent in the process? Said Wes coldly. Just one more day in hell, eh, General? Asked Semyaza. Hell. Stop playing games with me. You created hell to make men obey out of fear of your mythical eternal punishment. Real life is what you make it, said Wes, placing a rager edge on his words. But the spirit lives on, does it not? Asked Semyaza. Oh, forgive me, but coming from a being who lives 50,000 years, that doesn't seem too genuine, said Wes. 50 or 50,000, there is no difference, said Semyaza. There is a difference, or we would not be having this conversation. We live again another day in another place. You, my ancient friend, do not. We were born with a free will. You took yours off the shelf and were condemned to die for it. And now you want to take all of us with you. Isn't that the truth? Spat Wes. Is that all, General? Asked Semyaza calmly. Yes, that is all. I will dismiss myself, said Wes as he snapped to attention, did an about face, and marched across the black granite floor and up the stairs to his command center. As he cleared the corner, revealing the long glass wall between the hallway and the large room full of low cubicles, he glanced up, scanning the room for a head dropping or a man ducking behind the water cooler into the server room. All was in order. His staff was perfection, even when they were not being watched. They formed the perfect cohesive human machine, making countless judgments no computer could ever make. It was a flawless foundation for the tower he had built, far greater than anything Nebuchadnezzar ever dreamed. Today he would climb that tower and shoot his arrow into the very heart of God. He reached his personal suite, opened the door, and slid his encrypted magnetic ID card into the slot by the door. The LED lighting came on with a noticeable click as the main power contactor engaged. It was not opulent by any means. No woman had ever been in this secured suite of rooms, thousands of feet beneath Cheyenne Mountain. The smell of female perspiration assaulted the flawless control he had over his presence and his ability to affect that of others. To be safe, the suite was abated by a professional sterilizing crew once a quarter. Although he was immaculate, with the second bedroom he had turned into a closet, and his kitchen and bathroom were squared away at all times, the removal of mold and dead skin cells and hair follicles the eye could not easily catch, or the HEPA-filtered vacuum he ran nightly before bed could reach, was a calm few could appreciate. If anything, his opulence was in the freedom from decay in his private space. He pushed the button on the console by the walnut case holding the last folded American flag ever hoisted over the Capitol building. Mozart began playing with his symphony N40 Molto Allegro, after which he knew 3 hours of piano sonatas would follow. His trusty Avalon Isis speaker system was once rated the best audio imaging equipment on the planet. The vibrations were flawless, as though Wolfgang was playing in the living room right now, in person. Every time he listened to this piece, perfectly placed in the room by the spread between his electrostatic speakers, he marveled that such genius could have been scratched onto parchment in the year 1791, and that nothing since had so moved a composer or a listener. The cellos, violas, and the gentle flutes and baritones and French horns flowed together, bordering on the melancholy, and deftly, perfectly, floating over the serene and sometimes even humorous movements. He unbuttoned his dress blue jacket and hung it on a wooden hanger and slid it into place next to a dozen more just like it. He ran his hands over the medals and the brushed silver stars on the epaulets, while moving his other hand through the air like Mozart, anticipating the notes as though the score was written on the full-length mirror in front of him. He moved his tie and pulled it through the brass comb, holding 20 more on top of it. He had a first-in, first-out method for ties. It kept the plain, dark-blue ties free of wrinkles. He clamped the cuff of his dress-blue pants and hung them in the long part of the closet, along with the rest of the 100% worsted wool slacks. He turned around to face the other full-length mirror and the floor to waist high drawers made of satin-finished cherry. He pulled open a drawer and withdrew the Air Force jumpsuit still wrapped in the dry cleaner's plastic. He removed the plastic, stepped on the foot lever and dropped the wadded wrapper into the bin and removed his foot. He stepped into the dark green flight suit and zipped his arms into the long sleeves, zipping it up the middle to his neck. The black stars were sewn into the shoulders, and the sack, patch, and Air Force seal were the only things on the front. The elastic band around his middle shaped the suit to his lean frame. He opened another drawer and withdrew a blade cap, sliding it over his closely cropped hair to the proper distance from his nose. He walked out of the dressing room and into the black and stainless steel kitchen. He scooted his juicer away from the rear splash so he could add the foods that made up a flight meal. He learned in fighter school that the fruits and kale and protein powder provided the fuel for sharp thinking without cramping the bowel at 8 G's and heart turns. He recalled the instructor trying to make him vomit by doing praying mantis moves with the F-18 while he did battle space calculations and correctly plotted shooting solutions on 10 other aircraft. "Is that all, Captain?" he smiled in the mirror as he recalled the pilot trainer's lack of a reply. His Cuisinart crushed the ingredients and expelled the precise amount to fill his square glass. He dumped the remaining cellulose into the trash compactor and washed the machine, scooting it back into place. He marveled again at how Mozart's fingers could write and then play through the sonatas with allegro and even vivissimo keystrokes with perfection. Many pianists could play the pieces, but to have written it and played it with pianos made from no artificial components was beyond comprehension. "Sometimes the phenomenal is accomplished with the mundane," he said to the clean granite island in the center of the kitchen. Everything squared away. He turned down and then off the music system. He looked around his living space to make sure everything was in its place. He slid his feet into his flight boots and zipped them up the sides to a perfect fit. He removed his card from the slot, and the main contactor clicked again, dropping the suite into darkness. The armored door clicked securely as it closed by itself behind him as he walked toward the tunnel shuttle. He liked the jumpsuit. There was no heavy jacket to restrict the movement, and he lengthened his stride, feeling the muscles agree with the exercise. No one ever looked at him, but he knew everyone was looking as his blade cap sliced through the air of the hallway. He knew it was not just the flat black stars on his jumpsuit that intimidated them. There was no need to see Semyaza. He continued across the mezzanine without looking down to the situation room floor, where he knew the sleepless being stood, perhaps watching him march for the shuttle tunnel. Today, he would command the most devastating air-to-ground battle ever conducted. The Looking Glass ship would fly higher than ever before, perhaps to 55,000 feet. The communications would reach for hundreds of thousands of miles. The maneuvers he had plotted for the ships were elegant and simple, yet required coordinated turns in formations through the emptiness of space. The thought of being weightless all the time thrilled him. There were brief moments during a dive or a power-off maneuver when a fighter jet that approached weightlessness, but they were always preceded or followed by heavy gravity conditions that were hard on the human body. To fly in space was the dream of every fighter pilot. Today was his day to command. Today would clear the history books of all descent. The shuttle crew saluted as he approached, and he snapped it back to them. He smiled, briefly disarming them. but they knew better than to engage in small talk. "Welcome aboard, sir," said the staff sergeant, standing at attention. "As you were, sergeant." "I hope the traffic is not too bad today," said Wes. "Straight shot, sir. Fasten your seatbelt, sir," said the staff sergeant. With that, the shuttle door closed with its lone passenger and began its electromagnetic acceleration to nearly 200 miles an hour while closely floating above the guide rails. The air handling system moved the air out of the tunnel ahead of the craft, so the only sensation of speed was provided by looking at the yellow LEDs along the ceiling of the tunnel that appeared like yellow topaz snowflakes rushing over the glassed windshield in front of the passenger compartment. In less than an hour, he had reached the Denver Airport Station, deep under the public facility. His electric shuttle was waiting, and the white-gloved driver stood ready in his beret and bloused fatigues. The shuttle door sniffed open, and the airman saluted. He stepped out onto the shuttle station floor and began slowly walking for the shuttle, releasing the airman with a casual salute to slide into the driver's seat. "You mind if I ride up here with you, airman?" asked Wes. "Not at all, sir," said the airman, swallowing against a nervous bile trying to climb up his throat. Wes slid into the seat and put his right foot up on the low shelf in front of him as he gripped the bar curving down beside him for stability. It would be a shame to delay his climb to the stars by falling out of a low-speed electric cart. As they emerged from the underground hangar, he looked up to see a high gray sky. That meant little, if any, turbulence during their climb out with the looking-glass aircraft. He could walk around the command floor and look at all the monitors that would track every moving thing in the sky or on the ground. It would take an hour to get to altitude, and the 6 major harp stations would be heating up the ionosphere about now. In a few hours, they would push the Earth's protective ionosphere 80 kilometers out into space, forming a giant parabolic dish off of which the extremely low-frequency component would be focused to bounce out to the other Earth rising in the Arctic sky. The signal program was developed by psychological warfare experts who experimentally determined the right amplitude and frequency patterns to force the enemy's bowels into convulsions. First discovered in 1893 during the Columbian Exposition, Tesla inadvertently made his good friend Mark Twain crap his white dress suit pants. Since then, military-funded psychobiologists had developed field weapons that could weaken and demoralize an entire city, making the job of going house to house clearing the bad guys a safer job altogether. Not many people could muster the will to fight after 18 hours of convulsive diarrhea. Then there were the thought disruption signals that were laced into the HARP technology. During the planning of Desert Storm, when President Bush first announced Operation Desert Shield, Semyaza had shown him the voice of Allah. It was an electronic signal that could make the mind see divine visions and seemingly hear the voice of Allah. After all, for more than 1,400 years, the religion of peace slaughtered nearly a billion innocent people in the most horrible ways, without so much as a post-it note giving the order. In a few hours, it would be used to bring the Creator's voice to billions of souls on that world, huddled in their homes and their basements, waiting for the bombs to drop. They would be offering their silly prayers and tuned into some official evangelism being applied like the balm of Gilead to their despair. Just at the moment when they would think that their God has abandoned them, the voice will come, and with it, the judgment they were taught and feared every day of their lives.